call this meeting of the Legacy Committee to order. We don't have a quorum yet, I don't think, do we? I will have our quorum call later on. Somebody objecting to the quorum? Well, I would like to... All right, you're on detention. Well, first of all, after 34 years teaching seventh graders, I appreciate that. First, I'd like to. All right. That's it. One more. I'd like to thank Ms. Fuhrer and Como Park for the very fine presentation this morning. I think we really enjoyed the sights out there, and we did see the baby giraffe and the baby orangutan. And I was a little bit taken aback, however, as I was approaching the hearing room, and someone outside said, "Go in and see the sloths." For some reason, I thought they're talking about legislators. But I quickly was corrected that that's not what it was about. And there is now a quorum. So a quorum being present, we have to get approval of the last minutes. And Representative Lilly.
Yes, sir. I so moved.
Approval of the minutes has been made. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Minutes are, we have minutes. Continuing. Sign in, please.
Great. This afternoon, my name is Michelle Furr, for the record, and I am the director of Como Park Zoo and Conservatory. And with me, I have Jackie Stiga, the president of Como Friends. But first off, I want to thank those who were able to join us this morning on our tour. And for those who weren't there, I did a little screen captures from some of your Twitter accounts and some of the photos from this morning. For those who were not on the tour, we did a little visit of some of the work that we've done in the past biennium of our arts and cultural heritage funding. We stopped and visited one of our residency program classrooms, and then we got to go and visit our giraffes, and some of you were able to feed Skeeter and give him some green beans and asparagus. And then we stopped by and saw our baby orangutan. So for those who weren't on the tour, you're always more than welcome to come out, and we'd be happy to give you a tour of the facility as well as some of the work that we've been able to do. For those of you who aren't familiar with Como Park Zoo and Conservatory, we are the number one visited cultural destination with nearly 2 million annual visitors each year. Como is for all Minnesotans. We covered this a little bit this morning with one of the questions, but 47% of our visitors come from the Twin Cities. Only 16% come from the city of St. Paul.
Ooh,
still moving. 22% from greater Minnesota, and 15% come from out of state, contributing to the tourism market of the Twin Cities and Minnesota. We have a $22.3 million economic impact to the state, including that 270,000 people that come from out of state. But we are a mean, lean operating machine. We have visitors that come at $4.25 per visitor compared to other local cultural destinations that are ranged anywhere between $20.50 to $45 per visitor. So our budget is very low, but we are able to touch thousands and millions of people each year and be able to do the things that we do. If you were here earlier, you saw our Hoffman Two-Tones sloth that is in our Tropical Encounters exhibit, as well as Turkey, who is one of our parrots that's an education animal that goes all over the state visiting classrooms. And our budget, Como does not charge admission. We don't charge for special exhibits. We don't charge for parking. The budget for Como comes from the city of St. Paul, 42% from the general fund. We are owned and operated by the city. We also have 16% from earned revenue, from commissions, from catering, from wedding ceremonies, and from fee-based programs. 21% comes from our voluntary donation program. Over $1.4 million came from the boxes as people come in and drop a dollar bill in when they come in and visit. 11% comes from Como Friends, which Jackie will share a little bit about their background and what they do for Como in just a moment. And 9% comes from the state, from the Legacy Fund, as well as some funds from the Lottery and Loon Fund from DNR. But Como is much more than just a place to come and see animals and eat plants. We're a science learning environment. Over 425,000 school-age kids come to Como in our formal education programs. That means they may be coming for a classroom like you saw this morning. They might be coming, we might be coming to their classroom, and then they are doing a second piggyback trip. But 425,000 students from Minnesota are using Como, and you can see on this map that represents where they're coming from. So Como Friends is the nonprofit partner of Como Park Zoo and Conservatory. We inspire community generosity to advance Como as a destination where Minnesotans from all walks of life can gather, learn, and enjoy the natural world. This highly effective public-private partnership between Como Friends and Como Park Zoo and Conservatory is investing in capital improvements, free daily education programs, and best practices so Como can best serve a 21st century audience. Public funding paired with private dollars has extended the impact of education programs and exhibit renewal projects funded with arts and cultural heritage funds at Como. For example, Como Friends is investing in the residency program, which for those of you who visited today, you got to peek in as they were taking their pretest this morning. Little Explorers and Nature's Engineers so that we can meet growing demand and extend state investment. There's a growing body of research that is finding that visits to zoos and museums, destinations like zoos and museums, can help close the achievement gap between students from low-income families and students from high-income families because it gives them an opportunity to have hands-on experiential learning. As a result, we believe it is very critical to invest in education programs that are provided free of charge to visiting families or school groups so every child from every county in Minnesota has access to nature-based hands-on learning regardless of their family's economic situation. And we know at Como that we have a greater responsibility to provide this service because 7 out of 10 families that visit tell us that the free admission was part of the decision they made in coming to Como. So we're reaching an underserved audience that really doesn't have access anywhere else in the state of Minnesota. Como Park Zoo and Conservatory is a good steward of state funds. It uses legacy dollars to benefit Minnesotans from across the state. It leverages funds provided by the state with dollars raised from the private sector, extending the impact of programs. And Como has a sustainable operating model that is supporting smart growth and well-thought-out program improvements to best serve our nearly 2 million annual visitors. So as Jackie mentioned, the strong public-private partnership, even before the required 25% match on our projects for Legacy, we were already doing the match by leveraging the private dollars from Como Friends. So the past success utilizing the legacy funds, and I apologize that my screen keeps bouncing, so I'm going to try to keep it on the right page. This past fiscal biennium, we received $500,000 per year, and we were able to accomplish a lot with those dollars from STEM-focused education programs like Little Explorers, Project Passport, and our Nature's Engineer, as well as the Hoofstock Habitat Renewal that you saw this morning. Our work on the Centennial Garden that will be opening as part of our 100-year celebration of the Marjorie McNeely Conservatory, and a series of music elements to bring the arts to a number of very diverse audiences with our Music Mondays, as well as Groovin' in the Gardens and Music Under Glass. But increased funding will increase the impact. Our current appropriation is around 28 cents per visitor at Como compared to other cultural destinations in the area that range anywhere between $1.30 to $1.75. We would improve access and historical preservation of the Marjorie McNeely Conservatory and the Como campus. We'll continue and increase STEM-focused education programs, bring in special exhibits that will introduce new audiences, and do a new habitat renewal in our Big Cat area. So improving access and preserving our historic conservatory, the front door area has always been a hard area for our guests, especially those aging guests that are coming in, and bringing back some of the elements of the historic Como Park from the 1800s. Improving aesthetics to replace worn sod and asphalt to have better and safer accessible paths. Increasing our STEM-focused education programs. As you saw, the residency program is in its pilot year, and we would like to extend as well as add so that we can encourage other schools within the state to be able to appreciate and take advantage of those programs. introducing a teen conservation circle. Right now we have a teen nature walk program that's just in the summer. This would be a year-round education program that would be focused on projects in conservation and continuing Little Explorers and Nature's Engineers. Interweaving arts, culture, and history into the Como campus. A few years ago, as part of Legacy Dollars the first year, we've had an exhibit that paired funding from Como Friends called Blooming Butterflies, and we still, after 6 years, still get requests of where the butterflies are. So our hope would be to return butterflies in 2016 and add other immersive special exhibits. We did tarantulas, we've done partnerships with the Bell Museum, and right now we have a photo exhibit in our gallery. And then expand the music series, offering a venue for local artisans as well as introduce diverse audiences to music. Similar to our Hoofstock project, do big cat habitat renewal, preserving our collections and intertwining additional interpretive graphics. Everyone learns in different ways, and this will be a great way to showcase that. So our request is for $1.5 million per year in arts and cultural heritage legacy funding so that we can expand our programs to all Minnesota residents regardless of economics, income, and have access to learning and science education, and preserving Como as a top Minnesota cultural destination. So that's what we've prepared today, but we are available for any questions that the committee may have.
Okay, thank you. And I just want to say I was particularly impressed, you know, looking visiting the classroom and watching them all busily working away. I said this to some, but, you know, when I was teaching, I would walk into my classrooms, or they would come into me, and I would say, what are you here for? And they would all yell back, because I trained them, to learn. And when I just gently asked a young girl in that classroom, so what are you here for? She said, I'm learning. And I didn't even have to prompt her. It's very. Any questions by committee members? Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the presenters, my question also is about the STEM-focused education program and just the mechanics of it. Those kids, I assume, do not stay at the zoo while they're here, do they?
Chair Erdahl, Representative Torkelson, currently they don't. They spend the entire week during their normal classroom hours at Como, and we do teacher workshops so that we can incorporate their natural curriculum into those programs. But our hope is to expand the program, especially to what we found is the time it takes to get to the destination. So by expanding the program, we can reach greater Minnesota and tie in an overnight as part of the element of their week-long experience at Como.
Good answer.
Thank you, and I just might add, I don't think the extra cages would be proper.
Depends on which class.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you very much for having us out this morning. I just really love Como, and I've always been blessed, you know, having three young kids and living fairly close. It's just really been and we really didn't have much money, and it was just really a blessing for us to be able to pop over there and do, you know, really affordable experience, and kind of in the middle of winter it can just change you going to conservatory or whatever. But a couple years ago, I was just curious if you still do this. Do you you had a lot of vendors that came in and told about different school opportunities, and we just happened to be there on a very nice Saturday, but they had all these different vendors, and one of them was a school of rock in St. Paul. And so my daughter she's pretty musical since, you know, early on, so we signed her up for the school of rock because she wasn't really your typical college, or she was in choir, but it really wasn't her thing. So then she's a student now at the School of Rock, or was, and then she ended up going to Berklee College of Music, which is one of the top music schools. But I really credit that day at Como that led to the School of Rock, that led to Berklee, and anyways, it's a pretty amazing journey. Just curious if you're still offering, having
sure.
those vendors and coming
Chair
in?
Chair Representative Lilly, yes, that is a partnership. So we not only educate with our formal education, but we like to give the opportunities to Minnesotans and have things like our education resource fair and camp fair. And we partner with Minnesota Parent, and that will be coming up in 2 weeks, the 28th of February. So if you haven't signed up yet for your summer programs and other educational experiences, but we bring in 40 different vendors that offer education opportunities across the state and are able to use that as an open house for them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It was really a life changer.
And just Representative Lilly.
Thank you.
Representative Kahn.
Well, I think this is sort of following up on what Representative Lilly has said, but one of the things I think that's so important with the programs that we have at zoos, botanical gardens, astronomical observatories, and so forth, is that it's kind of the first step that kids get to an attraction into a career in STEM. I can always point out, as the only licensed scientist on this committee, I think, I don't know who the new people are, I'm probably also the only one who grew up within walking distance of a zoo and a botanical garden. So I definitely say it has a push to one's career if you do that.
Representative Kahn, were you able to walk to the baseball park too?
Yeah, that's but that didn't work. I've given up. I had given up one of my career ambitions. I think that's passed me by, which was to become baseball commissioner. So,
thank you. Any other questions or comments from members? Well, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, we have an overview of the Department of Natural Resources Land Acquisition Program. There's an awful lot of discussion about land acquisition ever since the Legacy Act was put into effect after the 2008 election, and I thought it would be a good time today to just have a discussion about the status of land acquisition, how it's impacting the state of Minnesota, and answer questions from any committee members. And so with that, we have Commissioner Meyer here today. Would you identify yourself, please, for the record?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. With me today, I have Pat Rivers, who's wearing two hats today as our session legislative coordinator, and also he works full-time with the Division of Fish and Wildlife as their land acquisition supervisor. So he, when we're not in session, he spends all of his time working on this subject of DNR land acquisition, making sure it's done the right way and making sure all the paperwork gets signed. So we're going to walk you through some acquisition stuff and hopefully have time for some questions and see where we go from there. In your packets, you should have three documents. One will be a copy of the PowerPoint presentation. Another one that we'll be referring to says Strategic Land Asset Management, a legislative fact sheet, and then just a list, kind of a reference sheet, if you will, of PILT payments that I'm going to be referring to county by county, talking about before calendar year 2012, after some changes were made to PILT, and looking at that net change. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I will just start our presentation, if you don't mind.
Thank you. Continue.
So just briefly, I think you're all pretty familiar with the Department's Natural Resources Mission Statement. We work with the citizens of the state of Minnesota to conserve and manage the state's natural resources, provide outdoor recreation opportunities, and also provide for commercial uses of natural resources in ways that create a sustainable quality of life. This is a diagram I like to use when we're talking about the DNR's mission statement that kind of shows these three circles and where we try to operate at all times, which isn't possible, but obviously if we can stay in the middle, recognizing the recreational opportunities, the economic development, and natural resources protection, we're trying to keep everybody happy. Whenever we stray outside of that middle into one of those other circles, it seems like there's issues that we have to deal with stakeholders, with legislators, with citizens. But it's usually for very good reasons. And kind of what we're talking about today is the realm of those three circles, looking at land acquisitions for outdoor recreation, economic development in some cases, and also natural resources protection. Now, as we talk about land, everybody says, you know, DNR owns all the land in the state of Minnesota, and, you know, how much land is enough and things like that. I think it's important just to take a quick step back and actually look at the land that we own. We own 2.5 million acres of school trust land that was given to us at the period of statehood for the children. We manage these lands for timber, for mineral resources, and also right now they have outdoor recreational opportunities that is not a charge on anybody at this point in time. Another set of lands is 26,000 acres of university trust land that came through in the same way. Really what you're focusing on, Mr. Chair, and the committee I think is interested in is acquired lands. So out of this basically 5 million, almost 6 million acres of land that we have, we've only actually purchased 1.5 million. There's also 83,000 acres of school trust land that is under federal protection, the Boundary Waters Canoe area that we're working to exchange with the federal government. Consolidated conservation lands are another category of lands that were given to the state back in the 1800s when the counties in northwestern Minnesota were going bankrupt, and for the state to assume their debt, they gave us these consolidated conservation lands, many of which are wooded, forested lands used for outdoor recreation. But also on these properties, the counties receive half of the income net. It should have half of the income gross. So any forest activities that we're managing through the Division of Forestry, the counties get half of those proceeds before any of our costs are paid. Likewise on mineral revenue. So there's another economic benefit of those Concon lands. Then the Volstead lands, 31,500 acres of lands came through the state during the Volstead Act. We could get into all of those different things if you so desire, but it's just a brief history of how we got the land mass that we have. So you can see that the DNR total managed lands is 5.7 million acres, but only 1.5 million of those have we actually purchased. And the county has managed 2.8 million acres.
Excuse me, Representative Murphy, did you have a question?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just two quick questions. From whom did we acquire the school trust land?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, the school trust lands, Section 16 and 36 of each section of land were given to the state from the federal government when we became a state upon statehood. Those lands were to be used to provide funds into a trust for the children of the state of Minnesota. Many of those lands in fertile areas or the agriculture part of the state, all of those lands have been sold. And actually, I have a map that I'll show you here that will show you where those lands are. So in a couple slides forward.
And Mr. Chair?
Representative Murphy.
Of all that land that you just had, is any of that overlapping? Are each of those acres a separate acre of all of that you just described?
Commissioner Meyer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
So just to answer the question that was asked there, you can see the Enabling Act of 1857 gave the state those school trust fund lands dedicated for the use of schools. And then if the lands were not available, if there was something encumbered on that 16 or 36 section, or somebody owned those lands, there were an alternative or indemnity lands were selected, which comes up to 2.9 million acres at the time. Swamp lands, and again, going back to kind of the history of some of those lands, congressional grant of 4.7 million acres of swamp lands. There are identified lands on plats, field notes of government surveys from back in the day. Then the university lands came to the state in 1857. Talked about the internal improvement lands, so that's another category of lands that are under the Volstead category. And then Concon lands forfeited for the non-payment. And then the Volstead lands as well. So there's brief history in each of those slides for you to go back and look. This map here, the green, I think it shows up pretty good. Those are the school trust fund lands that we've talked about that we've given to that are still in state ownership. Many of them are there because nobody wanted to buy them. Actually, it's timber value that some of it has good timber value, some of it has moderate timber value. A lot of it is swampland, as we talked about the swamplands that are there. Now, this map shows, I believe, what most people in the legislature have concerns about with legacy funding and land and DNR. These are the acquired lands that we've bought in as a state. So right now it's 1,579,000, a little bit over 900,000 acres there that we've bought. Doesn't show our conservation easements. We do have a large number of conservation easements, some of which have been purchased through the Outdoor Heritage Fund. focusing in the Grand Rapids, Aiken, St. Louis counties area with the Blandon Forest Legacy easements. I believe that was 48,000 acres. This table, or this map shows, and somebody was asking us for this at the legislature, it's a map of county ownership, or public land ownership by county. So this land would include the school trust lands, it includes the Bundjewater Canoe area, but it's all public land in counties that are there. And you can see where the concern comes up in the Arrowhead in Kuching County sometimes because of all the public land that are there. Actually, most of the northern counties have significant land masses that are non-taxable.
Commissioner Meyer.
Yes, sir.
What kind of land is that? Is that, are we talking mostly wetlands?
Mr. Chairman, this map would depict everything that's there that's in public ownership, be it federal ownership, state ownership, all of those land categories that we've talked about. So it's Superior National Forest. It's the Chippewa National Forest. Well, this is just state land? Okay, so I apologize. I was thinking of a different land. So this is just state ownership by county. So this would be state forests, state parks, wildlife management areas, aquatic management areas, scientific natural areas, outdoor state recreation areas as well, like up in Gilbert area. I have a different slide that I can show you that will list all of those land categories that are actually part of that map.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members, this is a graph of DNR fee acquisition by fiscal year. One of the concerns that has been expressed to us in the past is that, well, since the legacy amendment started, did land acquisition skyrocket? And I think you can look at this, and it shows that it hasn't. It fluctuates year to year based upon willing owners and willing sellers, but it hasn't skyrocketed since the amendment passed. We still are acquiring land for strategic purposes with our stakeholders in the legislature. Another question that I believe you'll be talking about at some point in time, I know what folks are talking about right now, are payments in lieu of taxes. This slide shows the increases in the payment in lieu of taxes program since 1979 to 2013. And what I really wanted people to take a look at are the jumps that are there. The history of PILT, and we spent some time as an agency doing an in-depth analysis of the PILT program several years ago at the request of the legislature. It used to be you'd get 0.75% of the appraised value or a set rate in statute. That rate had been stayed the same, but you can see the first major jump in 1999 to 2001, you can see the inflation adjustment was added for lands paid at a per acre rate. So the per acre rate went up. Then there was another jump. Most counties between 2001 and 2007, because of the rising land values, switched the form of payment that they could receive for PILT from the flat rate to 0.75% of the appraised value. This is the same period of time that we saw rapidly growing land values throughout the state of Minnesota, so that the PILT payment jumped from, it was about $14 million, I want to say, in 2004, to about $17 or $18 million, I think, is depicted in that graph in 2007. Those land values then are reevaluated every 5 years, but you can see the slight increases there are due to increasing land values and a few acquisitions. The major jumps that occurred in 2011 and then in 2013 were changes that came about from our PILT study that were there that show there hadn't been an increase in payments in lieu of taxes for all of those lands that we haven't acquired. So county tax forfeit land, school trust fund lands, the CONCON lands, the LUP lands. Counties received a significant jump in payments in those land categories. And those are lands, as I had said, were never actually acquired before. So if you look at the sheet that I've handed out for you all, it shows by county gross payments in 2012, the gross payments in 2014, and the change in those payments. And these are for all PILT categories, but the PILT change was $5.6 million in those 2 years, between those two fiscal years. And the amount of land that we acquired, I can get that land for you, but the amount of land that we have acquired in that time period, the PILT obligation would be less than $250,000, or right around $200,000, $250,000. So legislative changes made to the PILT formulas. The point I'm trying to get across to people is that the legislative changes made to PILT formulas and non-acquired lands are really driving the PILT payments and not acquiring land, as some people are concerned about.
Commissioner, is it still the 3/4 of 1% of appraised land then?
Mr. Chairman, members, yes. You can. There's two different ways to calculate your PILT payment if you wish. One is 3/4 of 1% of appraised value, and the other one, I don't have it in this presentation. I can get it for you though. It's a formula driven payment. It's $5.33 per acre, and that has gone up since 2012. So that's, you can either get 3/4 of 1% of your appraised value, or $5.33 an acre. A lot of counties that have swampland, lands that have minimal values, will take the per acre payment. But most counties now within the state are taking the 3/4 of 1% payment, which gives them more revenue in their PILT payment.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, with that, I'd like to just discuss the benefits, the environmental benefits, the economic benefits of public land. And actually, I'm going to have Pat Rivers talk about that. And then he's also going to talk about how we go about identifying parcels to acquire, why we do it, and the benefits that are provided from that as well. So, Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Identify yourself, please.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. My name is Pat Rivers. I work with the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. As Bob said, I'm wearing two hats as legislative coordinator, and then my typical day job is as Fish and Wildlife Land Acquisition Supervisor. Some people may view state lands as sort of an either-or proposition in terms of economic benefits. Either you make money in terms of timber or perhaps mining, or you don't. Maybe it's a state park or a state wildlife management area. The truth is that all state lands are part of a resource-based economic engine in our state. Forestry provides about 30% of the state's timber fiber, with 62,000 jobs are supported through state forestry products. This past year, state land, $70 million in royalty revenue came our way, with $51 million benefiting the school trust. And visitors to parks and trails in Minnesota spent almost $450 million in local trip spending. While not all land and waters are public, certainly the public land base we have supports a vibrant fishing and hunting economy in Minnesota. We also have environmental services or benefits that are also provided by public land base. Public land is known to hold water on the landscape, keeping water clean. In a few minutes, I'll talk about an acquisition that was actually targeted at protecting groundwater as well as providing good terrestrial habitat. Perennial vegetation also is great for soil conservation, which also benefits water. And lately, we've been hearing a lot about pollinators and the benefits they have for our community, and certainly diverse native habitats support pollinators as well. When I go fishing, when I go to Leech Lake, it's a whole different experience for me personally than it is if I fish on Mille Lacs or a different lake that is not supported by a large public land base. Yet these environmental benefits can be quantified as well. There have been a number of studies that have shown that the return on investment for public lands can range up to $5 for every dollar invested. This study was done a couple of years ago looking at Minnesota lands. We've also seen additional studies looking at the investment of the SARD SAMS Outdoor Heritage Funding and other investment of public lands. As Commissioner Meyer noted, lands acquired by the DNR are classified by the Outdoor Recreation System, Minnesota Statute 86A.05. There are 13 different classifications, and really we're talking about 8 of those 13. 5 don't have a lot of active acquisitions at this time. I'd like to walk through some of the strategic acquisition planning that each of these programs does.
Mr. Rivers, we have a question with Representative Murphy. Would you
care to answer that? Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess maybe because I'm newer to the committee, I have a few questions, but I'm curious about the statement that you made about the difference of fishing in a lake that is surrounded by public land and one that's not. And I'm just wondering if you could expound on that a little bit, please.
Mr. Rivers.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, for me, when I go fishing and I'm on Leech Lake, I was a Leech Lake manager for a number of years, It's a whole different experience when you're looking at a public lakeshore that is not developed than one that is, let's say, Mille Lacs Lake with 50-foot lots and houses every 50 feet. That's a personal choice for me, but I think a lot of Minnesotans appreciate the undeveloped nature of our public land base.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Murphy?
And thank you. Is the fishing any better?
Mr. Rivers?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I think it depends on the day, but certainly it's always better
or the fisherman
have a better sense of place.
Or woman. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I'll continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I like the term angler myself. So now I'd like to just talk briefly about some of the strategic prioritization that the programs are doing. And I want to remind you that we're dealing with willing sellers. We're not talking about condemning land or using eminent domain to get to a public land base. And we also work hard to have outreach to county boards so they know the direction we're going with acquisition. In 2002, a number of conservation groups helped the DNR develop recommendations for acquisition for wildlife management areas. The plan was called WMA Acquisition in the Next 50 Years, and that group recommended 702,000 additional acres to support the wildlife management area program. That was a recommendation to the department, not necessarily marching orders, but it was helpful to see what they came up with for products. One of them was this map, which showed approximately 11% of the land to be acquired in the future going to the northern forest. That's recognition of the strong public land base up there already, and it also shows where future investment should be directed, which is in the prairie. We've used this citizen plan to help us prioritize acquisition in our funding request to Lasard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council, the LCCMR, and additional dollars we use for acquisition.
Mr. Rivers, is there a number of acres that the DNR has projected into the future for land acquisition?
Mr. Chair, members, I don't believe we have a set number of acres that we are trying to get for a goal. I think, as you'll see in a moment with our strategic land asset management, we're looking more at how the land portfolio performs as opposed to getting to some arbitrary number of acres.
Okay. So for those that have this plan that or this thought that DNR is trying to take over the whole state, that wouldn't be accurate.
Mr. Chair, no.
Thank you.
Again, in 2008, a number of conservation groups came together to help the DNR prioritize or strategize on how to go about acquiring aquatic management areas in the future. And unlike the WMA plan, the aquatic resource in Minnesota is truly most dense and still pristine in northern Minnesota. So much of the investment for AMAs is geared to the north. However, I should state that much of it is toward the kind of the southwest portion of that northern forest, Cass, Crow Wing, Hubbard counties, areas of the state that don't have a lot of public lakeshore. For acquiring WMAs, we use a geographic-based scoring system where we put the shape of the acquisition in question into a database, and we score it based on a number of criteria. This objective scoring helps us compare acquisitions across the state. Things in the scoring system can be adjacent to existing public lands, wetland complexes, native prairie complexes, and a number of other factors. This SWAT score, as we call it, Strategic Wildlife Acquisition Tool, is reviewed every couple of years to ensure that we're acquiring the best lands that we can. The SWAT score is one part of acquisition or prioritizing. Things such as management importance, which aren't scored so well in that tool, are also considered, as well as potential once-in-a-lifetime opportunities. If we don't act now, we might never have the chance to acquire a certain parcel. This is the funding history for wildlife management areas over the past 10 years. I want to note the surcharge is a $6.50 surcharge on all small game licenses that hunters buy, and half of that money is dedicated for acquisition. That provides approximately $900,000 per year. The RIM bonding should not be confused with the Bowser RIM easement program. This is the Reinvest in Minnesota Critical Habitat program. So that money is matched with donations of either land or cash. In 2013, the Game and Fish Fund was no longer allowed to be used for acquisition, so you won't see that source going into the future. Here's the funding history for AMAs, and this includes Outdoor Heritage Fund, bonding, LCCMR, Heritage Enhancement, which is lottery and lieu proceeds, and also Game and Fish. For the Parks and Trails, recently they released a system plan. This 18-month planning process designated parks and trails as either a destination park or trail, core or rustic. And as they move forward with acquisition, they're going to be prioritizing their work in high-priority destinations, high-priority destination parks. This is the funding history for state parks. The 2008 year was the year money was appropriated for Vermilion State Park. Coastal Zone Management is CZM. That's a federal excise tax that comes in small amounts to the state. There are 58 state forests across Minnesota, and they prioritize acquisition primarily based on access. Parcels that provide access to lands with no public access or make better access for management or the public are their highest priority. The second priority is for consolidation, trying to eliminate boundaries where they can. I'll have a great example of that in a moment. And finally, resource protection. This map depicts statewide acquisition priorities for forestry, and much of the work that they've been doing the last several years has been in the southeast. Here's the funding history for state parks. State forests with bonding and outdoor heritage funding as the two sources. The Scientific and Natural Area Program's goal is to ensure that no single rare feature is lost from any region of the state. This requires protection and management of each feature in sufficient quantity and distribution across the landscape. This map isn't necessarily their wish list, but rather identifies parcels that meet their strict criteria for inclusion in the Scientific and Natural Area Program. They have a very rigorous evaluation system, including a number of factors such as habitat for rare species, quality of native plants, as well as parcels that are not included in the current Scientific and Natural Areas Program. Funding source for Scientific and Natural Areas is here, with bonding, LCCMR, and Outdoor Heritage funding being the primary funding sources. I'd like to briefly talk about Strategic Land Asset Management. The acronym that we use is SLAM, and I was on the initial implementation team, which is known as SLAMIT. Strategic Land Asset Management is an umbrella under which the DNR assets, land assets, are optimized for use within the context of all Minnesota public lands. The goal is to focus on collaboration between the DNR staff, which hasn't always happened, and improve that coordination with other public land managers and with the public. This is a map of a number of counties we've undertaken the SLAM projects, where we meet with different counties to talk about land holdings and try to maximize the use or the efficiency of those acres in each of the counties, not only for the state, but also for the counties themselves. Here's an example of a St. Louis County product. Now, this is a potential land exchange that would benefit not only the state, but St. Louis County. I want to emphasize again, this is a potential land exchange, but you can see the benefits that could be had. The left map shows a number of parcels that are scattered or isolated, and by working with the county, we can consolidate lands for better, more efficient management of those lands. This past winter, each of the regions undertook a scattered lands analysis, looking at DNR holdings that were small in acreage, that were not close to other state lands, and considered what lands could be potentially sold or divested. This example from Wadena County identified 870 acres of lands that could potentially be sold. This is a provisional number. We have the regions, all divisions, coming together later this spring to look at those acres to ensure that those make sense to sell from a state perspective. Other regions of the state have also done a scattered lands analysis, and these counties are represented here.
Mr. Rivers. I'm noticing that Meeker County is included in here.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Any particular area there that you are looking at?
Mr. Chair, it's all lands within Meeker County that were considered scattered. I can get you a list of parcels that and their...
Well, my house is considered scattered.
Mr. Chair, aside from your house, we're talking about public lands that the state of Minnesota manages.
All right, continue.
I'd like to bring up two acquisitions that we feel are indicative of how the DNR operates and pursues strategic acquisitions. This one is in Nobles County. It's the Worthington Wells Wellhead Protection Effort, part of the Lake Bella Wildlife Management Area. This area is a small watershed with limited surface or groundwater resources, and the strategic acquisitions we've made here were first meant to benefit groundwater protection, but they also benefit surface lands and people to use them for wildlife management areas. There are multiple benefits of those acquisitions, and Pheasants Forever was a major partner in this acquisition. The second and last that I'd like to show is an acquisition in Wabasha County, a 130-acre acquisition, a real in-holding, if you will. Acquiring this 130 acres eliminates about 2 miles of state forest boundary that needs to be posted and managed, and makes management efficiency much easier when it comes time to harvest forest products. With that, I thank you for your time and stand for any questions.
Thank you. Representative Murphy M.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Rivers, you mentioned the purchase of Vermilion State Park in 2008. It's 2015 now. How far along are we on the development of the park? Mr. Meyer?
Commissioner Meyer?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy. Pretty far along. Actually, we're hopeful to be cutting opening the campground this summer. The governor's fishing opener is on Lake Vermilion, and we're hoping to have a lot of events there. I believe the Capital Investment Committee has been there several times. We hope to bring them there again this coming summer. The first campground opportunity will be open this summer. There's a road, a new paved road through the park. You can get to some day use areas. There's a dock there. We have several boat-in campsite opportunities going on right now. So we're very excited to showcase that this coming summer.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Murphy.
Commissioner Meyer, is the underground mine park that's attached, is that as open as it used to be?
Commissioner Meyer?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, we did have an issue last fall with the elevator shaft that we were able to spend substantial resources to get that up and running again. We needed to close it temporarily until that was repaired, but actually last year we've combined the two, so now it's called Lake Vermilion Sudan Underground Mine State Park. You got to get a really long sweatshirt to put the name on there, but it's still there. It's still a very important part of our mining heritage, and we will keep that as a very valuable asset to that park opportunity.
And
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Myers, what other amenities beside the campground and the road is available to a family that would want to come to Lake Vermilion Underground, Sudan Underground, Big T-shirt Park?
Mr. Chair.
Commissioner Meyer, I got a shorter way to say that, but I'm not going to.
We are working with a large number of day use areas. There's some hiking trails that are open. There's snowmobile trails in the area that run through the park. So those other day use opportunities are coming along. We anticipate to showcase some of those with the opening of the park. We're also looking at, and we can certainly meet with you and go through the plans of the park, perhaps a zip line, some more outdoor recreation-oriented day use areas in the facility, talking about where, if and or where a visitor center should be located. All of these plans are coming together as we're starting to break ground and open that first campground loop. So we could certainly come back, and if you like, Mr. Chair, we could provide you an update with a more detailed information at a committee hearing in the future.
Thank you, Commissioner Meyer. I think that would be good. Also, when you have the zip line, I think that many members of this committee would like to participate in watching you do that.
Oh, watching you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Rivers, you mentioned in your presentation, excuse me, earlier that Game and Fish Fund is no longer allowed to purchase land. Can you refresh my memory on how that occurred?
Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner Meyer.
Representative Torkelson, that was passed into law with the last fee increase on the Game and Fish Fund. So it's something we'd be more than willing to circle back and rediscuss with you all, but as part of a compromise in getting those fees passed in 2012, there was language added that said that they could not be used to acquire land.
Representative Torkelson?
I'll leave that alone. Thank you. My next question deals with isolated properties. How did we end up with so many isolated properties in the first place?
Mr. Rivers?
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, a number of them were gifted to the DNR. There was a time we weren't quite so judicious about what we accepted as gifts, and we would accept things that either had limited access or that we got for free. We don't do that as a rule now. I will tell you there was one WMA acquisition that we're trying to get easement access to, and I looked at it and thought, well, why don't we just sell it? It's 40 acres. And I heard back from the wildlife manager that they harvest 700 pounds of native prairie seed from that site for use on WMAs. So it isn't a simple analysis to say, under this size with no access, we sell it. We need to look at them in terms of how they meet the needs of the management units.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, and I appreciate that answer. I think that's appropriate. I assume that now you are, as you said, much more judicious about what land you actually allow to be acquired. So how are we doing on divesting ourselves of some of these isolated parcels, and are there restrictions that prevent us from getting rid of them?
Mr. Rivers?
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, I think we are leaps and bounds ahead of where we were a few years ago, partly because of the strategic land asset management framework that has been set up. Looking at isolated parcels in the way we did this year, on a pilot basis in each county has been very helpful, and I think as we go forward, we'll have more analyses like this. How many acres have we sold from this zero, but we've identified over 1,300 acres that seem to meet the criteria for a divestiture. In terms of are we getting better, we are working with a landowner trying to donate 70 acres. I can't remember which county it's in, but he doesn't have public access to that land, and we simply will not take that donation without a way to get to it.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One more area I'd like to explore a little bit is, you know, once we acquire land, we think it's going to produce wildlife. How much monitoring are we doing of these purchased lands as to how well they are performing in the area of wildlife production?
Mr. Rivers?
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, we have area wildlife managers. Perhaps the strength of the DNR is our footprint across the state with fisheries and wildlife managers not very far away from the resource. In talking with some of them, it isn't uncommon for them to visit their WMAs or AMAs on an annual basis, maybe even more than annual for highly used pieces of land. In terms of monitoring game production, I think it's done more at a region-wide level with bird counts and the roadside counts that are done, not necessarily how many birds or animals were produced on this one piece of land.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, if I may put a plug in here at this point in time. We've developed a system whereby you can go on our internet and actually put in a condition, WMA condition survey. So if you go to our website and you see rotting or you say, I was here, there's no birds, flooding, any kind of conditions, you can go to our website. I just pulled it up on my phone. You can't see it, but we can share the link with the committee, and you can go through and actually do that. We're able to do that with some funding through the LCCMR funding to help us accelerate that activity. So it's very important to us, and creating that transparency, a person can be out on that unit and pull up their phone. They could probably even send a picture if they wanted to of what was going on. So that in the response, we're trying to take a very, very active management, very more active management approach on our land management activities.
Representative Torkelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I would encourage that. I think that the state's going to own land. It should be meeting its intended goals, and I'm some of the DNR-owned land that I'm familiar with is not producing much in the way of huntable wildlife, and it needs to be managed better. Just acquiring more and more land just to say we can have it in state hands and think it might produce wildlife someday, to me, isn't good enough. We need to actively manage these lands so that they actually do produce the results that we're claiming we're going to get when we buy these parcels. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Torkelson. Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, there were a couple of things that some of us at least have been talking about, which is being able to use any legacy fund money to manage or to upgrade any land that has been established with legacy funds. Would you be capable of doing that, kind of thing in your budget?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, as a restoration or enhancement, you mean?
Well, anything. The basic thought I have, and it's one that I've been sharing with Representative Fabian, it may be the only legislative issue we agreed on in as long as we've been serving together, is that it's not supplanting or supplementing if you're doing something to land that you have acquired with legacy dollars. And it might take some of the, and I don't know how PILT would come into that too, if paying some of the, PILT is kind of a separate program, so I'm not as certain about that one. But is there any thought of how you could look at that and how you could figure out what a reasonable cost for the maintenance or enhancement and so forth of legacy acquired lands would be from any of the funds I'm looking at?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, would you be talking about like some kind of management fund, an appropriation into a fund, so to speak, or doing the activities on the lands on an annual basis?
Representative Kahn.
Both, I think. I'm talking about the fact is that if there are extra costs to DNR to manage land, which there clearly is, that have been acquired with legacy fund, is there some way of charging that back to the legacy account?
Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, we can certainly figure that out. The question would come into play where we do an acquisition that has multiple sources of funding,
sure,
for example, and how do we back that out?
We can
figure that out, and we need to do more of that. So, yes, on both.
Representative
Kahn?
Mr. Chairman, I think the arithmetic is kind of simplistic. If you've gotten different, you can figure out what the different sources are, what the percentages are, and then divide it appropriately. So,
Mr. Chairman,
Commissioner Meyer,
Representative Kahn, actually Representative Murphy has beat you to that, and when she was chairing this committee with the Bland and easement, there was a large amount of money appropriated to the department set aside for the perpetual care and enforcement and monitoring of that appropriation. So with that example in mind, most definitely we would be more than willing to sit down with you and the council and other folks and talk about that.
So Commissioner Meyer, you're saying that we've already set a precedent of using legacy money to pay for maintenance or enhancement of legacy purchased land?
Mr. Chairman, it was an easement enforcement and monitoring appropriation that had specific statutory language associated with it to deal with the care and the enforcement of that. It's 48,000 acres of easements, so it's a substantial piece of property that needs to be maintained. And there's not so much maintenance, but it's more enforcement in dealing with if a portion of that were to be encumbered, the landowner did something with it that we would need to go to court with them on. It would be paying for some of those costs as well, but certainly we can look at that example and try to figure out what we can learn from there to move forward.
Okay, thank you. Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Commissioner Myers and Mr. Rivers. Thank you very much for coming. I served on some of these committees now a couple years, and it's fascinating to me as we're looking at the land, and I'm really happy to hear what you're talking about, that you're looking at the quality and assessing that. And I loved your little story on the seeds because, you know, it is, you know, I'm sure it would be easily to look at it and say, hey, sell this off or whatever, and I would just see that parcel and would not realize that it's yielding such a value. And but I'm sure there are ones that you're finding that are sellable that Representative Torgelson's referring to. So congratulations on that and keep that up. I've often wondered, you know, especially sitting on this committee with the so many of the multi-use jurisdictions, and that's kind of been my continued interest is, you know, to get folks out there walking on these, you know, as best they can, but I mean, preserve the nature of it, you know, so they're not damaging the wild flowers per se, but figure out a way that we can get people to utilize all these funds in, you know, sort of synergy. So you'd have a walking trail and maybe a some sort of art component or something. I don't know how you figure that out, and then perhaps something to shoot at, you know, so that group's happy. And anyways, I know the commissioner lives in an area fairly close to me, and I happen to be out there, and I think we're doing a pretty good job of creating wildlife over in the East Metro. It's amazing. I had my dog out, and we had, I think there was about 20 deer and a 3M property, a Mation property, and about 15 wild turkeys. So whatever success is going on there is measuring. I don't think that's public land, but certainly a lot of wildlife. But I guess my real question is, so I encourage you to look at the multi-use and all of us as we look at these funds and figure out uses, but it's important to me as we can. But I wonder if you ever get to a place where you've, you know, we've had this last year, I think Representative Carlson had the bill or amendment to limit that we could only pay so much for a parcel. And always that kind of comes up, and we never should pay more. But I wonder how often that's come up where you, because I think of like my real life experience where sometimes you want something and you're willing to pay a little more to buy it, or you're going to miss a parcel, you know, if you don't pay. I wonder how often that's happened in your experiences where we've missed opportunities as a state because we don't, you know, maybe pay a premium. I mean, there could be a trail link or a natural, you know, bird habitat that we're, you know, that we weren't able to acquire, you know, because you know, the price was higher. How often has that happened, or I mean, does it happen that we've missed opportunities by not? And I know with public money, it's always a nightmare, but I'm just curious how often that has really happened in reality.
Mr. Rivers?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lilly, how often does it happen that people want more money than we can give?
Well,
quite frequently.
I know that.
Okay. There are a number of times where we offer appraised value and the landowner comes back and says that's not enough. Most of the time, that's a done deal at that point. We really don't go above appraised value unless the parcel is truly outstanding or is kind of bigger than the sum of its parts. An example of that could be a water outlet on a designated waterfall lake, where control of that structure allows us to manage hundreds of acres, even though it might be $50,000 more than we want to pay. In those cases, we need approval by the commissioner if we go above that 110%. It's rare, though, and again, it has to meet that threshold of this is an outstanding parcel, not just for its own sake, but larger than its management purpose.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Lilly.
So, Mr. Rivers, how often would that happen? Once a year, or perhaps, or a couple times a year, or once every 10 years, or?
Mr. Rivers?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lilly, I would say once a year we have the opportunity to try to get commissioner approval for something like that.
Representative Lilly, you're done?
Okay.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to piggyback a little bit on what Representative Kahn was talking about in relation to the costs involved when we buy a piece of land. There are the costs of getting it into the shape we want it in, and there's the cost of keeping it in that shape, and maybe, you know, there's jolt and other issues involved. As you're evaluating these properties, the ongoing financial burden to the state, is that part of the consideration?
Ms. Rivers?
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, it is. And we do have dedicated funding through the Game and Fish Fund and other sources of funding, such as Lasard Stamps Outdoor Heritage Council, that which we do apply for grants for restoration work. In initial acquisitions, we seek initial development planning money to get the acquisitions up to speed to a minimum development standard, whether it's a parking area for users or whether it's establishing native prairie. So we do consider that at the time of application and when we consider different parcels.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, it seems like this year we're having a big question about trail maintenance. All of a sudden we need to find more money to maintain trails. Weren't those ongoing costs of maintenance considered when we established these trails?
Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner Meyer.
Representative Torkelson. Many times they are, many times they aren't. I mean, trails, as we saw in past bondy bills, are very popular things to fund. We have ongoing trail maintenance needs that you're very well aware are not being met. So we need to work together to identify a funding source for that ongoing trail maintenance. It's easier to establish a new trail than to take care of what we have, unfortunately. And we look forward to continuing that discussion with how we can continue to do both.
So, Commissioner Meyer, would that be your answer to the assertion or the comment, why should we purchase more land, why should we purchase more trails when the DNR can't maintain what they have now?
Mr. Chair, no, not at all. I did not mean to leave that thought with you. It's the land management is pretty easy to maintain. It's the trails. It's asphalt, right? It's $100,000 a mile to replace a trail or asphalt trail. That needs to be done about every 10 or 15 years. We have 2,700 miles of designated trails within the system right now that we have no designated source of funding for. So when we come to the legislature and we present issues to be discussed about funding, it seems like there's a little bit of funding for what we have and a lot of funding for new things that other people want. And I really appreciate Representative Torkelson bringing this question up because it is something we really need to talk about on the trail side for sure.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, we have, you know, my new job as a chair of the bonding committee, we have a similar dilemma. People would rather build a new building than maintain an old one. And I think it's, you know, part of our responsibility as legislators and employees of the state to make sure that these ongoing costs are recognized, emphasized, and addressed properly so that we don't get behind. When we get behind, then it's very difficult to catch up. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And I'm all in favor of repairing old buildings, you might know. Other questions? Just a couple that I have. How often does eminent domain enter in with DNR land acquisition?
Mr. Chairman, members, eminent domain are two words that we don't like to use at the DNR. We have the authority, but we very rarely use it. And where we do use eminent domain, it's for friendly condemnations that will benefit the landowner. So I do not recall the last time eminent domain was used, though we have been given the authority, most recently in the establishment of the Browns Creek Trail, but we did not have to use that power.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner Meyer. And if there were no legacy amendment, if it had never passed, how would that affect land acquisition in the future?
Mr. Chairman, without the legacy funds, we would be stuck with bonding funds, working with the LCCMR for funding for acquisitions. We would be seeking to change that language in the Game and Fish Fund prohibition for acquiring land. We'd be looking for whatever we could. I think the other piece of it is how would we be making up for the benefits that we receive from acquisition, from clean water, pollinator habitat, and those types of other environmental and economic benefits that are out there. I mean, you look at the acquisitions just on the clean water benefits alone, and most recently in restoring or retaining some water in lands up in the Red River Valley. How would we do those things that are so critical to the state of Minnesota and the other pieces that we do without it. I mean, we're one of the governor's big initiatives this year is buffer strips, right? Without these buffer strips, the non-point source impacts of these waters are going to be greater. And then at some point in time, do you come down to regulating non-point source sources of pollution? I think it's we can't lose sight of the fact that these acquisitions provide huge environmental benefits as well. So we would be searching, trying to turn over rocks like we had been doing in the past, not only just for acquisitions, but the Clean Water Fund, the arts and historical societies, the county fairs. You look at the Clean Water Fund and the Parks and Trails system without the state of Minnesota, not only at the state level, but the metro and the greater Minnesota parks. It's hard to imagine. It was hard for me to imagine what it was going to be like if the amendment passed. And now it's hard for me to imagine the work that we would have to do in the legislature to make up for all the great things that you all have done in the past 5 years without it. So that was kind of a long answer.
So basically you're saying that the bar graph would look like it kind of did before 2008, but that you would be having to look for all kinds of other sources of funding, for example, more bonding or recapturing some of the money that you had used before, but like in the Game and Fish Fund.
Mr. Chairman, correct.
Any other further questions? Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Meyer, at DNR, do you talk about what's going to happen in 25 years from 2008 and how you're going to adjust? Your programming and your what if the legacy fund isn't there?
Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, we haven't had a lot of discussions about that. I think we've been too excited about dealing with the present than looking into the future. But that is something that we really, really need to start preparing for and discussing. Not only the DNR, but all the stakeholders and the legislature as well.
Yeah.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, this committee probably should discuss that too, because we're not brand new anymore. And we should talk about where we're going and then what.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. Any other questions? Any concluding comments?
Mr. Chairman, members, I just want to say, first of all, say thank you for this opportunity. Any other questions people may have or questions we may have brought up, please let us know. And I'm hopeful that you do have a sense now that we do have a strategic process in place and we are looking at acquisitions very carefully before we do make them. So.
Well, thank you, Commissioner Meyer. I think this has been helpful to us, and the discussion will be ongoing. If there is nothing else, well, King, this case is closed.